Kim Misfeldt's professor of German and chair of the humanities department here at Augustana. And she has been part and parcel of the Canadian Summer School in Germany, which is in Kessel, for a number of years. A number of students in here, you probably know some of them, have been on that. And from my own point of view, anybody who can spend time in Germany is spending time in an extraordinary country with an extraordinary tradition. She teaches language, language, literature, translation, and gender studies, and has published on second language pedagogy, drama pedagogy, and on Kleist. She's been recognized with 3 teaching awards, including the 3M Teaching Award a year or two ago, and is one of the prize professors here at Augustana. So she's going to speak a little bit about teaching language, giving voice. But can I open with a little poem that I've read a couple times before, but I think it's worth reading every time, associated with our general theme? It's Douglas Lacan. And without a core of courage, how can anything ever be achieved? Can anything be built? The courage and courage shadowed by weakness may be the most precious of all, since it carries sweetness into the heart of the building, carries it like honey into the hollows of the honeycomb. So.
Thank you, David. I know that most everybody knows me, but there are a few people around the table that whose names I don't know, so maybe we could just go around the table anyway, because I imagine that I'm sure that maybe you all know each other, but maybe not. You want to start, Alan?
I'm Alan Ford.
Trevor Thompson.
David Goa.
Thank you. And I'm Kim. The schedule that I was told is that I should talk for about 20 minutes and then let everybody else ask questions. So that's what I'm aiming for. We'll see how it goes. I put some important quotes for me on the board. I just want us to read through them before I start, because I'll be referring to them perhaps again and again, but I think that it's important to hear them as well, because we may take for granted that we know Augustana's mission statement, for instance, but how often do we actually read it or take it to heart? So I'm going to read it for you. I know you all can read, but I'll read it anyway. Augustana aspires to educate the whole person in an intimate small campus setting so that students and mentors alike are capable of engaging life with intellectual confidence and imaginative insight, equipped for leadership and service, and committed to the betterment of their world. That's pretty big goals. From Bell Hooks, educating is always a vocation rooted in hopefulness. As teachers, we believe that learning is possible, that nothing can keep an open mind from seeking after knowledge and finding a way to know. From Paulo Freire, education must begin with the solution of the teacher-student contradiction by reconciling the poles of the contradiction so that both are simultaneously teachers and students. The question of vocation is about why I do what I do. And all of this has to do perhaps with the educating part of what I do. I also spend a great deal of my life actually in this room, in meetings, for a variety of reasons as an administrator. And often the question is, well, why would anyone be an administrator? What's the there's no joy in that role. There's no so then I turned to the Dalai Lama. All human endeavor is potentially great and noble, so long as we carry out our work with good motivation, reminding ourselves that my work is for others, it will be of the benefit to the wider community. These are things that mean a great deal to me, and to which I turn in moments, perhaps when the hopefulness is not as obvious. Let me begin by telling you about three students. The first student was in his final year and was taking a literature option class with me during my first year of teaching at Augustana. On his evaluation, he wrote that this was the first class in which he felt that his opinion truly mattered. The second student, a senior who had enjoyed a language class with me, decided to enroll in a literature class. After I had explained my expectations for the course, she came to my office to withdraw. She explained that she was afraid that she would be unable to express her own opinion regarding texts, as I had required. I encouraged her to stay and try. She soon gained confidence using the tools that I give all my students and came to my office very excited. She was successfully expressing her opinion in other classes as well. The third student was in my German language and culture class as part of the Canadian summer school in Germany. This student played the class clown but wrote serious, profound journal entries describing thoughtful reflections on his experience of living in Germany. This Jewish student had grown up in Toronto, where he had attended Jewish schools until university. He had learned to hate all things German. He stated that no one he knew would ever even consider buying a German-made product. But at university, he took a history class that got him interested in Germany, and he began to study the language. While in Germany with CSSG, he encountered a young man who said, "What Germany needed today was for the Nazis to come back and clean things up again." Instead of allowing this experience to reawaken his earlier feelings about the Germans, this student was able to reflect critically on the experience using what he had learned through his experience in the CSSG program and in my class. He could no longer think of Germans as a single entity, and he was able to see the many shades of gray between the black and white thinking of his upbringing and of the young German. Although rooted in the course material, the lessons learned by these students give evidence of the vital importance of how one teaches, the learning atmosphere one creates, the questions one asks to motivate critical thinking. Like bell hooks, I believe that my own hopefulness in the classroom leads students to realize for themselves that learning is possible as they find their own particular way to know. My teaching philosophy was influenced by my mother, who started her teaching career in a rural one-room school. When she died in her late 70s, many of her former pupils, including some she had taught more than 50 years before, wrote to us of the tremendous impact her teaching had had on their lives. As a child, I witnessed her dedication to her pupils. She always had time for them, even long after they had left her classroom. I chose to come to Augustana in 1991 because of the value it placed on teaching and on the student as a whole person. And as I look back over my 20-plus years at Augustana, I realize that a lot of what I do is fostering similar connections with my own students. The unifying theme of so much of what I do is found in the words teaching language, giving voice. Teaching language, and we have a number of language teachers here today, teaching language is so much more than vocabulary and grammar. It opens doors for students to new ideas, cultures, literatures, and ways of thinking. I empower my students to become autonomous learners, to develop their voices throughout the learning process. Students find their voice in my classroom because they quickly learn that I truly value what they have to say, both about their learning and about themselves as people. I believe that it is crucial to offer students a wide variety of activities, assignments, and critical approaches so that they can experience multiple ways of learning. I work by designing scaffolding assignments and tasks that challenge students to achieve more than they believe is possible. In setting such challenges for students, one must provide and allow them to practice with the tools they need to achieve their learning goals. A bit about my history. When I did my PhD, which started in the late 80s, I guess I started in 88, I did my bachelor's degree and my master's degree at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon. And for my PhD, I went to Queen's in Kingston. And at that time, well, I have to tell you that as well. My story is absolutely not a usual story for academics. I didn't plan on doing my master's. I did my bachelor's degree in languages because I love languages. In my first years of my university studies, I studied German, French, Ukrainian, and Norwegian. And I would have done more if I had more time and had more ability to fit them into my schedule. And everybody thought I was crazy. Everybody said, "Kim, what are you going to do with that?" I thought I was going to do translation. And I was accepted into the UBC after degree program in translation. I had never considered teaching because my mother was a teacher. I come from a very large family as well. I'm my mother's 10th child. My mother was a teacher, my oldest brother was a teacher, and one of my sisters was a teacher. My brother and my sister both hated teaching with a passion. My brother would vomit in the morning before he went to class. He hated it so much. So I never considered teaching. So I wasn't going on a straight path at all. But after I was accepted and planned to go to UBC, they canceled their program due to budget cutbacks. And so I was sitting there thinking, what should I do? When I was at the University of Saskatchewan, and one of the people who organized the evening courses for the community said to me, "Kim, we really need somebody to teach this class. Will you do it?" And I said, "Well, okay." And I taught that course. It was the first course that I had ever taught, and I loved it. And the students loved it, and I just said, "Oh, I guess this is a good path for me." I did my master's because I was able to, had the luxury of being able to do them, my master's. I hadn't planned on doing my PhD, but at my master's defense, the external examiner from Queen's came to me and said, "Why don't you come to Queen's to do your PhD?" I said, "Oh, okay, I'll do that." So I did that, and I loved it. I loved learning. I loved teaching. At Queen's, I wasn't even looking at jobs to apply for. And I had finished my 2 years of coursework and was in the midst of my comprehensive exams, which in those days meant that you studied, you had a year to read, and you had to read everything from 900 AD approximately to the 20th century at that time. So you spent a year reading absolutely everything in German literature that you could, and which is an amazing gift, but also an amazing task. But I was in the middle of my exams, and one of my professors said to me, because I wasn't looking at job ads or anything, he said, "Kim, there's a job out here, out in Alberta, and it sounds perfect for you." I said, "Oh, okay." I applied for the job more for the sake of practice than applying for the job. Chet Olson, who many of you know, called me up and said, "Would you like to come for an interview?" I said, "Yes, I'd like to come for an interview." I came. Again, it was a 30 below day when I came for my interview. But being from Saskatchewan, I was eager to get back to the prairies, get back to the sunshine, even though it's minus 30. And I was very excited about the opportunity to come here. So this job was the first and only job I applied for, which, yes, is quite something when I say it out loud. There have been many times over the years where Augustana has had a variety of troubles, and languages have been in trouble over the years because people, in order to learn languages, you have to work hard and work regularly, and lots of people think that's too much work. And so languages, people say, well, A, the whole world speaks English, so what do we need languages for anyway? And we don't really want to work that hard. So languages are expensive. That will be the first place to cut. And unfortunately, that's the case across the country. So there have been many times over the 20-plus years that I've been at Augustana where the hopefulness isn't as readily found, wasn't as readily found. And I had to ask myself, okay, why do I stay? What's important to me? And I believe that language in and of itself is a political act. The words that we choose and how we use them say a lot about ourselves as people, but also about what we believe about the world. Language is a living thing, and as it changes, we too must change with it or decide to be left behind. And I think that it's so important that we understand the value in the words. And so teaching a language, and I'm sure that my colleagues here in the room can attest to this, when you're teaching a language, you explore the meanings of the words that you use every day without thinking about them. So often we use words and say, oh, it's just a word. It doesn't matter. So I often get students as experiments to then change it. Well, if it really doesn't matter, let's put something else in there and see, well, wait a minute, no, I do have some emotional attachment to that. There obviously is something in me that believes it should be this way and not this way. And that's the wonderful fun of studying languages and literature, because literature is about as well the value of the word, the value of how you say things and why you choose to say it in the way that you do. One of the authors that I have done research on is Maria Lemaire. And she is a Swiss Yenish author. And some of you have heard me talk about her before. She writes novels about people in Switzerland, and particularly the Yenish people, but not always, not significantly. But she's always looking at the role of violence and how violence plays, what role violence plays in our society and in our families. And one of the things that she said about why she writes the novels that she does is she says, and I'll say this in German and then I'll translate for you, ich wollte allen eine Sprache geben. She wanted to give everyone a language. That's not a specific language like German or French or English. It's about giving people the vocabulary they need to be able to understand and talk about their experience. And a reason that this is so important to me, as well as to Maria Lemaire, Maria Lemaire was herself a victim of a tremendous violence and had lost her own voice. She didn't speak at all until she was 6 or 7 years old, and she then developed the ability to find her voice. Not because anybody helped her with that at all, unfortunately, but she was able to find that. She was able to find a lot of it through reading, actually. She loved to read, and she believes that reading literature is what saved her life. And that's a really interesting thing, because we turn to other people's stories in order to find meaning for ourselves. And in my own past, and many of you know this already about me, I was sexually abused as a child and had also lost my voice. Not physically, but certainly in many ways. I had, as the 10th child in the large family, if you don't have a loud voice, you tend to become invisible. And that was the role that I chose, was to become invisible, to be the one who is the very good little girl and who follows all the rules and therefore doesn't get noticed. Those of you who know me may find that difficult to believe, but that was indeed the case, that I was invisible. And part of my story about giving voice is about finding my own voice as well. It's about understanding how we need the vocabulary in order to talk about our own lives. We need the vocabulary to be able to talk about our emotions. And those are the things I needed to learn. I didn't have any vocabulary for what had happened to me. I didn't know how to talk about it. I had to learn that. And in that way, it's very similar to learning a foreign language. Because when you start learning a foreign language, for those of you who have tried it, we have to go back to being a child. We have to go back to having a very rudimentary vocabulary. We have to go back to stating simple sentences and making funny sounds and talking about things in ways that we hadn't talked about them before. And the same is true when you're developing an emotional language, I believe, because I had to learn from the very beginning, well, what does anger feel like? What does safety feel like? I didn't know. That word was especially meaningless to me because I didn't have a sense of what safety felt like. And so the vocabulary takes on such different meaning when we examine the power behind each individual word. I'm running out of time. Okay. I think that what's important that I want to say about educating, and so much of what I do, is about allowing students to determine their own path. As the same in any healing situation, we can't say everybody has to go down this path in this way. We can't say that everybody has to learn in the same way. We may know the shortcuts. As teachers, we may know to say, well, maybe this is a more efficient way to go than this way. But in the end, the students each have to follow their own path. And what I attempt to do in my teaching is facilitate that. It's about facilitating students finding their path. And what that means on a practical level, I'll just give you a couple examples, is that, for instance, the students decide what kind of assignments they want to do. The students decide what value, percentage value, those kinds of assignments ought to have. They decide what they want to learn about. Of course, I put a frame around that, but it is important that they have the opportunity to make decisions themselves about what they're doing and why they're doing it. As an administrator, again, nobody wants the job as department chair. Nobody ever says as their goal, I really want to be a department chair. No. At least I've never met anybody who's like that. But universities can't function without them. And because in the same way as an educator, I believe that my job as department chair is about facilitating again. And what I facilitate as a department chair is to support the work of others, to support the work that's happening, the teaching that happens in my department through mentoring, through helping faculty solve problems and crises, to help them work through conflict, even organizing workload. My goal is to have people in my department feel energized and enthusiastic about their work and not just exhausted by it. Too often, when you talk to faculty members about how they're doing, they're exhausted very, very much of the time. And so my question often to them is, okay, what could make this a job that energizes you and gives you life rather than just takes it? So I think it's the same thing, and you know, all of these things is again about looking at how I really believe that the world can only become a better place if we're able to put the whole picture back together. I want to read just, and then that will be the end of what I have to say, and we'll be happy to answer questions. I want to read one letter from a student, just to give you a sense of what I do. I guess I should mention, some of you know this already, but I do a lot of work outside of teaching German as well. I do costumes for anybody who was at the International Fashion Show for International Week a couple of weeks ago. Those are all my outfits for the theater. I've done a variety of co-directing for the theater as well. Working with students, working with faculty in all kinds of ways, for faculty follies. I tend to be one who can organize things. So I tend to like to organize people and get them doing things. So, yeah, it's a very wide spectrum, and I think that's the wonderful part about being at Augustana, which is a place that we're not in disciplinary silos. We're not saying that we... At Queen's, the German professors only knew the German professors. They didn't, you know, it wasn't... They wouldn't really consider knowing a math professor or what they might be doing in their classroom. And I think the real gift of Augustana is that we can know each other and we can know students and share that knowledge. So this is from a former student, and she writes, "Dear Kim, I'm writing this letter to thank you for all the support you have shown me in the last 10 years. I remember vividly the day we met. You were giving a presentation in my women's studies class on women survivors of sexual abuse. I don't know what it was about your presentation, but I got the courage to go to your office and talk to you. Even though you had no idea who I was, you treated me like I was the most important person in that moment. I had no idea the journey I was about to embark on and was very unsure if I could do it. You were there to support me every step of the way. Immediately, you had information for me where I could get some counseling and kept in touch with me to help me keep my courage up to actually go through with it. Thank you for never giving up on me. I would not be the person I am today if it were not for you. You taught me so many things. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be scared. It's okay to let go. Most importantly, you taught me that I could and would trust and love again. You have given me the greatest gift anyone can give, my life back. It has been a long and bumpy journey dealing with abuse. I know that I would not have been able to do it had it not been for your support. 10 years later, I am thriving in my life. I have made a lifelong friend in you. I don't think that a letter can truly describe the impact that you have had in my life and in the lives of many others, but it gives you a glimpse into the important things you do and are for your friends. As a scared little girl who walked into your office so long ago, I had no idea how much you would impact my life. Thank you." So to me, that's it. That shows us that we most often have no idea about the impact that we have in other people's lives. And we have no idea if they're actually learning what we think they ought to be learning. But what I always remind myself is that they hear things that we don't hear ourselves say, and they remember what they need to remember, and that's the most important thing. The other grammar rules and things like that they can look up in a book.
A number of years ago, just to pick up on your last comment, I mean, it is amazing in the classroom how often what is said or what is heard rings a chord and leads to a whole other kind of conversation. My kind of code for this is to always care for the soul of the student.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a number of years ago, this most dramatic moment when it was a course on the religions of Southeast Asia. So I'd been teaching about, I think it was a second class or something like that, and a young woman in the class sitting near the back started to weep. At least I thought she started to weep. And left the class. So, what did I say?
Mm-hmm.
What's going on here? And the next class, it happened again. And I don't know if it was the third or fourth class, but I met her just coming into the class. And I asked her she was looking pained then too, if there was anything I could do that would be helpful. And she began to weep and told me that she had just come from her father's trial. Her father had killed her mother. She had witnessed it. So she lost both parents, is the way she felt in that moment. And it is so interesting. In religious studies, it's really vivid because unless you deliberately choose not to, you're always dealing with these questions of ultimate meaning in one form or another. But with language, too.
Absolutely.
It just pops up all over the place.
Yep.
So, I mean, it is one of the amazing both gifts and responsibilities and challenges of teaching. Is hearing the voice that can't even be heard itself by the person, or at least seeking to be attentive to it without being nosy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have the great gift and maybe burden as language teachers in that the subject that people most want to talk about when they're learning a new language is themselves, mm-hmm. right? And so it does tend to be a very personal space. I tell my students on the first day and remind them over and over again, you're free to lie. Because I also tell them they're free to copy in language class, because of course that's what we do when we learn language. But without the freedom to lie, you don't have the freedom to be honest. And I think that we forget that sometimes we're asking, you know, even by asking very simple general questions that we ask in language classes, because we're in conversation all the time, that may be an extremely personal thing for a particular student. And that student may not have any desire whatsoever to share that with the class. And so it's so important to them, or to me, to be able to say, no, just lie. You know, you have the freedom to say, make up, you know, whatever you like, because you really need to have that freedom to hide yourself as much as share yourself, because learning language is a very vulnerable place. I mean, anybody who's tried to learn a language knows that. Because, as I said, you're reduced to a rudimentary vocabulary. You're making funny sounds that you're not used to making. You can't sound as intelligent as you like to think you are. You can't tell the joke that you normally would really like to tell to lighten that situation or lighten that moment. It doesn't work. So all of the things that you have grown up to hide yourself behind in your personality are taken away from you when you start learning another language. So it's a very vulnerable space, and we have to remember that. Yeah.
As you were speaking, I was reminded of Harry, who earlier in this series talked about being an accidental judge.
Mm-hmm.
So, did you hear the accidental professor? You see some common characteristics in the path?
I mean, I did, Kim. It was wonderful.
Well, I've always believed in following where I'm led. Mm-hmm. And so I obviously was meant to be here.
Mm-hmm. We're so thankful you were.
Thank you.
Anybody like to dip in here and respond and query and comment? And
well, I'm so fascinated by language and for a student of it. I only know one pretty much English, a few words of French that I struggled and failed in. But I was watching a program last night. Charlie Rose was interviewing some people from the Natural History Museum. One of them was Neil Tyson, who put out a new show on Cosmos. He's a stargazer, astrophysicist. I can't even think of the names. But he was talking about language, too, and some of the difficulty. He was talking about dark matter and dark energy. He said we shouldn't have called them that, you know, because those words have baggage.
Exactly.
And they conjure up ideas that we know something about. He said we should have called them bread.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's I think, the really, to me, really fascinating part of language is to say, well, why is it? And what's the baggage behind that word? What's hidden in that? What does it say about the culture that this word is so important? I find it so interesting, for instance, words that are not in another language. A difference between, this one always is funny. Germans believe they get sick from very different things that North Americans believe they get sick from. And so there are words for illnesses that exist in German that we don't have in English, which is quite fascinating, right? How can that be? We all have the same kind of body. How do we have different illnesses? And one of my friends that some of you know, Helen Moore, she grew up in France and in England, so she joins that conversation by talking about the illnesses that the French have and the British, and how different those are. The German, the French, and the British, the illnesses are different because of the words they have to describe them. It's fascinating. I always think with the students in the summer, they have I take them on various excursions, and so one year it was very hot and the air conditioning died in the bus, and so the students all believed, the Canadian students all believed they would get sick because the air conditioning had died. Germans, on the other hand, believe they get sick from the air conditioning. So I've always said I wanted to do an experiment and have two buses, half filled with Germans and Canadians, one with air conditioning, one without, and see who actually does get sick. But because our brains are connected to the words and how much we believe behind the words, of course they're going to get sick because they believe they're going to get sick. So, it's fascinating. I love it. There's no German word, and I keep asking this every year just for fun. Culturally filled words, those are the ones that I like to ask about these days and just say, okay, you know, what's the German equivalent for X, because it's become such an important word. And the one I like is cougar in English. Not, of course, referring to the animal, but referring to the woman who's going after younger men. And that word is used a lot. It's on, you know, like there's a TV show now about the cougar, and, you know, it's on, we hear about it lots. There's no equivalent in German for that word. They don't have a derogatory term for women who are after younger men. So what does that say? What does that mean?
It was normal.
Or maybe it just doesn't matter so much.
Well, you read Thomas Mann.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very common form. And the whole idea of the house friend,
yeah,
in German, where, you know, it's probably because older men tended to marry younger women.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the older men got older, the women needed a house friend. That's interesting. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's nice.
No problem. I have a problem. I approach the expression by exaggerating. I see you. You are not missing an arm. Your head is in its own place. I notice, and probably this is a cultural difference, I hear in North America an exaggerated use of problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you are very much right that we are living in a very problematic world.
Mm-hmm.
Because we use it without any sense, without any meaning. There is no meaning for it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My major problem, if I can add to this, echo what you're saying, Jim, as I echo most of what you said. It's just amazing. Different languages. I come from a French background. And the French have always have an ailment that has to do with liver.
Yeah.
And in English, when we talk about this, it just doesn't echo anything. It's nerves.
Yeah.
And it's in a similar area.
Yeah.
And some students thought that the French have many problems because of their perception of something that's foreign.
Mm.
And the whole concept of foreign, which first is, I mean, a foreign language is something that is out of you,
mm-hmm,
that at the first contact you want to stay away from because it's being altered. It's having to change. And once a student has had the courage to step into a class and to willingly become a bit different, a bit other, a bit foreign, maybe a bit of an actor. And when you say lying, that's a bit what it is you act because yourself, you are not, your identity is not in that other language. But if you can enjoy the step of being somebody else, and that's why I find it so interesting, is all the area of drama that you brought into modern languages.
Yeah. Yeah, and that ability to become someone else, I think, was helpful for me when I was a teenager and went to Germany the first time. Because being the youngest of 10 children, of course, everybody tells you who you are and has fairly firm ideas as to who you are. And so going to Germany at 16, all of a sudden people didn't know who I was. And I could determine that for myself a little bit more. And that was very freeing for me. And certainly I see that with the students that I take to Germany. We had one student, and she came back year after year. She did CSSG 3 times, actually. And part of the reason she did that was because of that freedom, because she was able to be who she wanted to be in Germany, and nobody was telling her who she was and how she had to be. So it, not only does it give you the freedom in the classroom to expand who you are, but also the freedom when you go to that place and say, okay, you know, this is who I want to be for this time, for this moment in time. It doesn't have to be. And that's the wonderful thing about languages as well, I believe, because you realize that you are taking on that persona for the moment, for 6 weeks, for whatever time, and it's part of who you are, but it doesn't have to be the whole truth of who you are. And I think that's a great gift.
Are you a different person in German than in English?
Well, it's interesting. I have many friends with whom I only speak English or German, mm-hmm. depending on the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And some friends that I speak to in both languages. And so there is that determination, you know, okay, does it... So they often say that my voice actually changes quite
yeah.
substantially. And so the intonation changes. The I don't think that I'm that different from one language to the other. Probably precisely because I spend so much time... I spent so much time through therapy working on who I am and deciding who I wanted to be and creating that person of who I want to be or who I am on the inside with all the aspects all the way around, that I don't think that I'm that different from one language to the other.
Do you have a sense that when you're functioning in German that your style is different than when you function in English? A different way
perhaps,
of presenting yourself
yeah.
in the world? I mean, I'm just curious.
I don't... certainly in Germany, it depends on where you're at. And Germans love titles, right?
Oh,
German,
yeah.
Germans love...
Multiple titles.
Yes. So, Frau Doktor Professor... So you have that respect for the professor that I think is very different from here. But I don't think, I don't act like that, and I don't take it seriously. And so I think I challenge that perception a fair bit. I don't think the style actually changes that much.
I read the biography of George Steiner, the great European intellectual here a couple of years ago, and it was fascinating, his discussion of his language formation, because he did not grow up with a mother tongue.
Mm-hmm.
He grew up with three or four of them.
Mm-hmm.
Hebrew, Greek, but commonly spoken, French,
mm-hmm.
German, English. And I had a sense that this person was a different kind of human. Well, he's such a brilliant person, but there's something very fundamentally different about that kind of formation.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that the more languages you have, I mean, as you said about the dark matter and how that limits our thinking by how we term it, the more access you have to more languages, the wider your opportunities are. Because, as we said, there are things that we say in one language we don't say in another language. So you have the opportunity to grow in more different directions because of things that are important in that language that may not be as important in the other one. So certainly. And there are certainly things that you can talk about differently in the different language, but because of vocabulary that make things possible. Do you think you're a different person, Valerie, when you switch languages? Yes?
Oh, yes. In terms of gestures, French is a lot more, at least my experience, volubile, a lot more expressive. So I learned when I came to this country to be a bit more subdued.
You weren't very successful.
No, this is subdued.
You weren't very successful.
Especially not to stare at people. Mm-hmm. Like I used to give my complete attention,
yes.
which also demanded that from the other person who would be in attention. However, the switch from one to another, which may be a question, from your authentic English speaking, your authentic French speaking, is done in a very smooth manner,
yeah.
because of the people you are with. And that's where community comes in.
Yeah.
And I think in languages, especially in your classes or in mine also, the welcoming of the way one person expresses themselves, although it may not be 100% correct according to, say, grammar vocabulary, that is welcomed and may be encouraged towards something a shade different without ever saying, this is wrong.
Yeah.
It's always right for that person at that moment.
Yeah.
And you may suggest that in different contexts, in different community, you would say it a bit differently in different words. But the person's authenticity or identity is never questioned.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the cultural differences, I mean, I can't imagine that your style is very different from one language to the next value. But certainly the cultural differences are key. I mean, I was on my last sabbatical, I spent 5 weeks in Mexico to learn Spanish or to begin learning Spanish. And there I spent a lot of time with Germans who are living in Mexico because they're teaching there with Volkswagen. And getting their sense of the cultural differences between the Germans and the Mexican people and what those cultural differences mean. So that's always fascinating as well, is to be able to investigate those questions and say, okay, how does this work then when a German who expects things to be this way wants to have a conversation with a Mexican who expects things to be this way? How does that interaction happen, and how can we facilitate? We have to understand where the problems are going to come, and they're going to come. The very first ones are going to come because Germans are direct. We tell the students in the first orientation session, Germans respect directness, polite but direct. Mexicans are absolutely anything but direct, and so how do we make those conversations happen when we start from such divergent places? But I think the key is to begin to understand where those divergent places come from, and then we can possibly have those conversations about what's different. There was a number of hands.
I have two comments and a question, and they're unrelated. So would you like me to take just one?
Go ahead.
Okay. When you were talking about words and the power of the words, I remember a conference I was at about 20 years ago where the speaker did an exercise on anger words and then happy words and the difference on how in business or in families you could move that bar up and down. Excuse my crudeness, if you say, oh, I'm so pissed off to get work versus, you know, I'm a little challenged. Mm-hmm. Immediately the response is emotional, and that was my first turn into emotion tied to words and love words. My other comment was sitting with a 4-year-old in a very critical situation for 3 months. The amount of health care providers that would come up and say, be a good girl. And we're just going to take your blood and we're going to put tubes in your mouth and everywhere else. But be a good girl.
Yeah.
Again, because of this conference, I said, could you say brave?
Yeah.
Because she could be a scared girl or a chicken.
Yeah.
And still be a good girl. Like you're layering on her, good girl, bad girl, because she doesn't want you to stick needles in her.
Yeah.
Anyway, again, the sense of words, so I appreciate you reminding me of this today. My question is accents. As a listener, there are many languages. How do you see the listener responding with acceptance or denial to accents? So when you're studying a language, and I would even look at Quebec and Alberta, the denial an individual can get if the accent isn't assumed to be proper. What is your take on that, if you've been in all these divergent situations?
I think you're going to find impolite people wherever you go. And that's what I would take that as. I take that as an unwillingness to hear what's behind the accent. Because in language teaching, we call that a sympathetic listener. the people who are willing, because as language teachers, we can understand when students are trying to say things, and we say, oh, okay, I know where that's coming from. I get a sense of what you're trying to say. That's a sympathetic listener. And unsympathetic listeners, yeah, they just say, that's funny, I don't understand. But that's a reaction to, again, as Valerie said, the reaction to the foreign. You know, just saying, stop, you sound different than what I'm used to, so you can't be taken seriously.
Thank you.
Your question is very much related to what King was saying before about language going beyond words and the meaning of words. And in that regard, as you forgive me, my arrogance, I was born in southern Spain and I grew up in a different region, a different dialect, in addition a regional language which added more complexity to life. And people don't take certain dialects within the same language, they don't take them as correct. We must understand that in order to be able to respect the other, we must understand that the community grows and the community has a value. We cannot say that that community is useless, it's a problem. Okay, so some people do not understand that, and then they will condemn you because you have a different accent.
Yeah, and I think that that's such a crucial part of language learning. When students will say, oh, but my German, you know, sounds like I come from Canada. Well, so what? Right? You come from Canada. I think this drive to perfection is ridiculous. Because we all have things in who we are that say where we're from. And part of that is what you sound like. And I know we teach pronunciation, and we teach it, I believe, I teach it for understandability. So I want people to be able to have an accent that others will be able to understand. But the accent is not about, and there's lots of research happening in this area right now, where they're looking at the drive to perfection, and is it actually causing more harm than good? Because it causes people, like Harry, to say, I failed when I tried. Right? Rather than saying, I didn't fail. I learned these words, and that's really cool. I know these words that I didn't know before. That's something wonderful.
I might have been able to learn French if I'd taken it from you guys.
Absolutely.
Sometimes
absolutely.
Cannot make certain
absolutely.
Terms in French.
Yep.
And I just sort of think of some experiences, in, especially Quebec. I was in a French school for 11 years. It wasn't bilingual, it was French. And the sense of failure, I guess, when you would speak to somebody in some places, there were many wonderful people, of course, that really would respond to you in English. And their English was worse than your French, conceptually.
Yeah.
But it felt like a put-down.
Yeah.
Like,
you know, absolutely.
I'm not going to speak French.
Yeah.
And you might even open the situation up and say, you know, please, my understanding is better than my spoken word, but I'd like to practice.
Yeah.
And they'd literally say, no, I will respond to you in English.
Yes.
And this would have been more in the 70s and 80s.
Well,
I've seen it a lot less. But when you're talking about hopefulness and global and interrelationship and language for food and cultures and experiences, I totally agree with you, but I think the world is fairly rich still on accepting when you're trying to communicate.
That's where stubbornness comes in. I mean, really. Both.
Okay.
Because what I tell my students in Germany, because they come across that situation a lot, where people, because they want to practice their English as well, so it's not just about being a put-down, right? It is also because the other wants to practice their English, and they're saying, wow, there's somebody from Canada in my store or wherever, and I this is a chance I have to be able to practice my English. I tell the students, be stubborn. You know, even though they respond in English, respond in German. You know, like, you just keep keep on that. And I've seen students who will say, I had one student, well, Graham Hafsel actually, when he was in Germany, and he had a student or someone on the street, you know, continually wanting to, and he just explained to him, look, in German, he explained it to him in German. He said, I'm Canadian, I'm here in Germany because I want to learn German, I want to practice my German. He explained the situation. And if the person at that point doesn't listen anymore, then go talk to somebody else. Because, yeah, you're going to find ignorant people all the time. And unfortunately, last night, a student was over. I had German movie night last night. And one of the students, she can understand very well, and she's very good, but she often responds, when other students speak to her, she'll respond in English. So I asked her last night and said, okay, why are you doing that? What's going on? And then she said, well, when she was in Norway at a course, there was a person from Germany there whose Norwegian was atrocious, but he felt he had the right to laugh at her German. And since then, she doesn't have the courage then anymore. And we forget that. We forget how fragile, how vulnerable we are when we're learning something new, whether it's belly dancing, whether it's yoga, whatever it is. Whenever we're learning something new, we're vulnerable, right? And the first time we try it, Alan knows this in yoga all the time, the first time we try something, we have to laugh at ourselves. We have to have that ability to laugh at ourselves. But I don't want Alan laughing at me, right? I can laugh at myself. But if Alan were to laugh at me, that'd be something different, right? So I think that we forget how easily we take to heart somebody's put down.
So quick supplemental with the English. I don't ever remember any situation where somebody criticized any other language trying English. So is there something different with the role language is playing in the world now?
I think English gets, there's still value judgments placed on it.
On accent?
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting.
Absolutely. I have a number of friends from England, and they place a value judgment within seconds.
Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. They know exactly where people are from and what that means, that they're from that and that they talk like that. So I think the value judgments are there in English. We just don't perhaps voice them as...
I think it's been a pretty common characteristic here in parts of Western Canada. It's probably faded now a bit, but in the past, and I certainly have it, if somebody has an English accent, I treat them two ways. I think just to illustrate this phenomenon. On the one hand, you think they're smart, just because they have an English accent. Or on the other hand, you have a kind of a slight visceral reaction against them. I mean, this was very much a part of the society of Edmonton. Certainly when I was a kid in the 50s, I remember seeing all kinds of signs in Edmonton where they were advertising for somebody to work, and they would have a banner across it, English need not apply.
Oh.
That's because Edmonton was owned by the Scots and the Irish, and they had enough of the English. So I don't think I'm really exceptional in that sort of just visceral response to the accent.
Yeah.
It comes from, you know, childhood, I think. For me, it comes from lovely neighbors who I adored, but who were English, and as a result, even though they had far fewer skills than my parents, I always felt like they owned this place, and my Norwegian family was here because they were generous. But I think that's changed a lot.
Yeah.
But in the 50s, it was still very, very much there.
Yeah, and I think that you see that, when we see that on campus, with instructors who are teaching, I mean, in languages, we expect Eugenio to have a Spanish accent, and we're happy about that. But if he were teaching computing science, then students might complain. and say, right? I can't understand. The first reaction is, I can't understand. As of course time passes, and if they're willing, you know, to begin to open their mind to say, oh no, I can't understand more than one type of accent, it becomes more possible. But certainly it's there.
But as you mentioned, David, I mean, it depends on the feeling you have for the community.
Yeah.
And it's changed between the 50s and maybe now. And in a similar sense, I found that accent is actually an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the response of the community that placed a positive value judgment on something different from what they have been used to, then the question will inevitably come, well, where did you come from and where did you learn English? And not in a put-down manner, but in a celebrative manner. And my experience has been very positive in that sense. The accent is actually, it's fun, it's good, it's enriching.
But I was reading a book called The Wayfarer, and there are 7,000 languages that have become extinct. And those people had to be absorbed into either English or Spanish or some other culture in order to survive. So there's that vibratory quality of those beings. And we even think of, you know, Treaty 6 and those people that spoke a beautiful language. They got absorbed, and what did that create? So, you know, just that, if that's a hell of a hard book to read.
Well, and I think that goes back to the hopefulness, because yes, if I can get disheartened quite easily and say, you know, well, what's the point? You know, why do we have to fight so hard to have language be recognized? Why do we have to fight so hard in the North American context to have people see any value in language? And yeah, you can easily go to that space. But I then have to switch that and say, yes, that is true. That is our situation in North America because English is taking over. At the same time, then, I have to go back to the stories of the particular students. And know, for instance, a student of mine, Adam, who is in Germany right now, and his whole life trajectory has changed so substantially because he bothered to learn German. He studied business in Edmonton, and he decided to take a German course, and then he came to the summer school in Germany twice, and then he did, because he enjoyed his time there, because he learned the language and loved the culture, he went back a number of times, and right now he's helping teach English in Germany. And he's also been on German TV because he plays the trumpet and he joins the orchestra in Leipzig. And, you know, like, when you see the amazing difference that can happen if one student is willing to be open and learn, that student and that student's children will value language in a different way and will work to protect the culture and the language that are in danger of disappearing. Sarah Breitkreuz is a fabulous example, because she was a student here and did modern languages and philosophy, and now she's doing her master's degree. She's not finished yet, is she? I don't think so. I think she's still working on her master's, but she is working on exactly that. She's working on preserving indigenous languages, because she learned the value of the language. And the student that I talked about at the beginning, the Jewish student from Toronto, he has lived in Germany, studied in Germany as well since that time. And you know that his children are going to be raised very differently than how he was raised. And that's the only change we can make. I'm not going to change Alberta government. We all know we want to try. I'm not going to change their ideas about second language learning, right? But if I can change one student and help that student find a different path than they might have found a different way. That's the only place to find the hope.
Kim, I think that you've got it exactly. I see us living in a, and this has been the human condition, in my opinion, for since human beings became conscious, is we live in a sea of ignorance. And a great thing about it is we are changing as more and more teachers come out to bring us out of this ignorance. But the thing is, you're doing it, and that should always give you confidence that you are making a change. Well, because you are. You're just wonderful.
Teachers have that effect, but you know, there were teachers at this school that did just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a child, I was not taught Norwegian. Why? Because of people in this place who were in a position of authority and who convinced my parents and their generation, who were not professionals but craftspeople, that you must not teach your language to your children. And you had the same situation. So there is no question about the authority.
Yeah.
But boy, there's a difference as to how you understand it. And in that period, and that was ubiquitous through Western Canada, and the story of the native people is part of this as well, and it was overt government policy and certainly part of teacher training. So that's one of the great shifts that's taken place really quite recently.
Mm-hmm.
So that the home language is no longer automatically barred. I mean, take Ukrainians who went to court over this issue and what have you for a period of time. But if it wasn't for the oblate priests, the native peoples wouldn't know any of their language.
Mm-hmm.
So they get blamed for the problem, but they're the ones who actually pulled it forward and did the primary work on this and tried to mediate between the state and those communities in the midst of a struggle around French and English.
Mm-hmm.
That was the other large struggle in Canada around French and English, which influenced all those school systems. So it's a marvelously layered and tragic at times story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's one thing I could change about Camrose, it would be that. I mean, in terms of, if you could go back and change your past.
You know. Never too late, David.
I agree with you. It's not too late, except, you know, well, we'll see if I make it through to Sunday. but, I mean, just it's curious. You know, I had ear infections as a child, and so I heard. So on the one hand, there was this physical challenge to hearing and perforated eardrums and what have you because there was no Medicare. And then the other thing is that my parents loved English and had great vocabularies. But they also loved Norwegian. And my father always spoke Norwegian with a rich brogue.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I was probably 35 years old before I finally had realized the connection between how you pronounce an English word and how it's written.
Yeah.
It was amazing for me. It was a huge struggle, to say nothing about the kind of Germanic construction mm-hmm. that came out of my father through Norwegian and English, and how that was bequeathed to me and certainly didn't go very far in English classes in elementary school.
I don't know why I want to say this, but I hadn't thought about it. My mother took German classes on Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that, of course, the war and the problem. So one sort of disappeared. But,
yeah. Well, and we see that too often. You know that the ideal is to assimilate. You know, and Germans especially were very, very good at that. And
had reasons to keep their head down.
Well, had reasons to keep their head down, but also taught their children. You know that in order to be successful, you know you learn only English. You don't learn any German. And that has changed. thankfully, but many, many people suffered under that.
And indigenous people.
Oh, absolutely.
Language to speak.
Yeah.
Or what language not to speak.
Yeah.
That certainly resonated with my mother, who was raised by Norwegian parents in Norway, mm-hmm. not far from here. She told me, much to her regret later on, that this would have been probably 30s or so, that there was a huge pressure to assimilate, and of course they all successfully assimilated. None of my mother spoke some Norwegian, but even her aunts, who only spoke Norwegian when they started school, in later life they were unable to communicate at all in Norwegian. But my mother told me that when she was at school, she did not wish to bring friends home with her, because her parents, my grandparents, spoke English with a Norwegian accent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, to us, it's just unbelievable. And fortunately, that has changed, because as Valerie says, there's a richness in accents, and I think most people recognize that now. But at the time, there was this enormous pressure to assimilate and to be exactly like everyone else, to the exclusion of their own culture. Not only their language, but their culture was obliterated because they lost their voice.
Yeah.
And I'm going to speak from the British.
Oh, good.
My background is British. I'm not British, I was born in Canada. But my mother's family and my father's family are British. And Mama grew up on the province east of here. And she was particularly, remembers very sensitive to the fact that in her one school, her British accent.
She was a minority.
As a minority.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in pockets of right here, there was ridicule.
Oh, and that, and there still is today.
Yeah.
Like I did a session in International Week for the international students. The International Week was entitled "Breaking Stereotypes," and we asked a number of our international students to speak at that. And some of the stories they tell about life in Camrose are very appalling.
Yeah.
Very appalling. We like to think that, and I think we do live in a very ideal place. But we forget, and that's why I think going back to the importance of hearing people's stories is actually talking to some of these students and finding out what their experiences are in Camrose. One of the students told about an experience at Walmart where she was putting her stuff on the van, and the person in front of her told her, "Get that off of there. I don't want your stuff touching mine." This year in Camrose. Right? So that kind of stuff is absolutely still happening in Camrose right now. And we like to believe it's not, but we need to listen to the stories of the people who know that it is happening, and also take our responsibility. For when we see things like that happening in Walmart or wherever, and we see that someone is discriminating in some way, that we actually stand up to it, you know, and say something about it, so that they realize that they're not alone in this.
Mm-hmm.
What was so amazing on that day was, and I asked a number of these students afterwards, you know, how do you, so much of what they said. But it's incredibly horrible stories, really. And I said, well, how do you keep your sense of, such a strong sense of self? And they said, well, you just have to. You know, you have to understand that doesn't have to have anything to do with you. It has to do with the person who's saying it. And while you know that's true, at that moment, it's still painful.
Well, thank you all for joining in this conversation, and thank you so much, Kim.
Thank you.